From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And as expected, former Vice President Joe Biden landed a key endorsement today from the most influential Black Democratic leader in South Carolina, Congressman Jim Clyburn, the House Majority Whip. He told Here and Now's Tanya Mosley why he's supporting the former vice president in South Carolina's Democratic primary on Saturday.
Joe, to me, has the background and experiences that I think are needed at this particular time in our history.
Can you tell me more on that? And you refer to him as Joe because you all have known each other for quite a long time.
Yes, yes. Quite frankly, I mostly called him Vice President until this week. I started calling him Joe for some strange reason. But temperamentally, I think he's what the country needs today. It is one thing to have preparation. It's something else to have the temperament. I think there are a lot of good, smart people who are good politicians, but temperamentally, they ought not be president. Hmm. And think when it comes to temperament, I think Biden has what it takes.
Biden will need the support of Black voters in South Carolina if he's going to win that state and keep his campaign alive.
Which he says he will do. Biden told CBS after the debate that it's enough if he wins by just one point. Domenica Montanaro, NPR senior political editor and correspondent, is here. Domenica, how do you think Biden looked after last night's debate and some of your overall thoughts?
Well, first of all, listening to that interview, I'm really struck by Jim Clyburn saying that temperamentally Joe Biden is best to be president while some others are not. And I don't think he's just referring to President Trump. You know, I know a lot of Democrats think President Trump obviously is not temperamentally fit, but you know, there's a lot that goes into, I had somebody who's close to Clyburn tell me a couple days ago before we knew who he was going to endorse that he just doesn't think Bernie Sanders is the right person to run. He doesn't think that he would help in the House. He's very cautious about what he would mean up and down the ballot. So that's a pretty important sort of tea leaf thing to read about what he thinks about Bernie Sanders, in my opinion. That's one. Two, as far as the debate goes, you know, this is probably the best 24 hours Joe Biden's had in quite some time in this campaign. He has, you know, gotten beaten up over the last several weeks by his own doing because of finishing so poorly in Iowa and New Hampshire. He had promised that he could do well with white working class voters. That didn't turn out to be the case. He said he could do well with voters of color. Well, he didn't do well with Latino voters in Nevada. He got walloped with Latinos by Bernie Sanders. And he promised he could do well with Black voters. Well, he won Black voters in Nevada narrowly. He had a pretty good debate last night, and he is staking it all on South Carolina, needs to win here to propel him into Super Tuesday, where half the states have significant Black populations.
But you mentioned Bernie Sanders, and he was the candidate. The other candidates wanted to speed bump last night. Remember, he told 60 Minutes it was unfair to say everything is bad about Cuba under Fidel Castro. Well, of course, he was asked about that. Let's listen.
When dictatorships, whether it is the Chinese or the Cubans, do something good, you acknowledge that. You don't have trade love letters.
This is President Biden. This is 2020.
Love letters. Well, President Trump, of course, said North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un sent him beautiful letters. We fell in love, a reference to that. But how do you think Sanders did?
You know, foreign policy has not been a major issue in the Democratic primary. Most Democratic voters want to talk about health care or climate change. But fundamentally, when someone's picking a president, they're picking a commander in chief, somebody that they want to see on the world stage. That's the kind of thing that comes into much sharper relief in a general election. And when you think about, you know, Sanders having said sympathetic things toward socialist regimes and then sort of backing them up in these last few days, it is the kind of thing that makes a lot of moderate Democrats wince because they just don't feel like putting somebody up against Trump, who is uses so much nationalist symbolism, you know, whether it's stand for the anthem or, you know, a host of anything else, to put somebody up who will essentially say over the last 40 years, the countries that were enemies, well, there were some things that they did pretty well. Of course, they, you know, you don't like the authoritarian parts of what they do, but there's nothing President Trump thrives on more than culture war, and certainly going to do that if Bernie Sanders is the nominee. You know, but we're in a different time. I don't know if that if the traditional calculations hold up.
Well, I just want to ask you briefly, we have just 1 minute left, about Elizabeth Warren, Senator, taking a number of shots again at former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. We'll take some of them up elsewhere in the show. She called him out repeatedly, though. He did some eye rolling back at her. He also said in the debate that he spent $100 million or so to help elect a number of Democrats. Mm-hmm. Almost said, I bought them. It, you know, seemed a little tone deaf there. Do you see him going beyond Tuesday?
He seemed to slip and say bought, actually.
Yeah.
But, but, you know, but here's the thing. A lot of the Democrats who did win are very appreciative of the fact that he did spend that money to help them win. And that has been the fundamental kind of problem or difference with Democrats, is that a lot of the policies and things that they don't necessarily love about Mike Bloomberg, they do want his money, though, and they want him helping them up and down the ballot.
Domenico Montanaro, NPR senior political editor and correspondent. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, right after South Carolina votes, the spotlight will shift to the 14 states across the country that vote on Super Tuesday. More than 1,300 delegates will be on the table, including California, the biggest prize with more than 400. We're joined now by Scott Schaefer, politics editor and host of Political Breakdown at KQED in San Francisco. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Jeremy.
So you've got some new polling results out of California. Senator Bernie Sanders has a clear lead there with 36% over the other candidates. Tell us more about what your poll says and what you're seeing in California as Democrats are voting already and preparing to vote.
Yeah, so this was a poll by Change Research for KQED, and it was taken right after the Las Vegas debate, so keep that in mind. But it shows Bernie Sanders with 36% of the vote among likely Democratic primary voters, followed by Elizabeth Warren at 18%, Joe Biden 10%, Pete Buttigieg at 9%, and Michael Bloomberg, who has spent an awful lot of money in California on television ads, is at 5%, and everybody is down below that.
And what about when you break it into some of the demographic groups? There are obviously a huge Latino population in California. What are you seeing there and with black voters?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of Bernie Sanders' real strengths in California. You know, he ran here 4 years ago, and he's really in many ways building on the momentum that he developed when he was running against Hillary Clinton. Among Latino voters in California likely to vote in the Democratic primary, Sanders gets a 41% share. That is quite a large percentage, especially when you consider that very few of the Latino leaders in California have endorsed Bernie Sanders. So this is really very much a more of a grassroots kind of a thing. And among black voters, where, you know, somebody like Joe Biden, you might expect to be number one, actually Bernie Sanders is on top with black voters, 34% preferring him. Actually, Elizabeth Warren is second. Biden is third in California in our poll among African-Americans. And Sanders also does well with Asian-Americans, especially now that Andrew Yang is out of the race. So he does well with all voters of color as well as all age groups. So he is very well positioned going into Super Tuesday. And, you know, both Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar continue to have a lot of hard time really connecting and getting support from voters of color here.
Now, one thing that is new this time around is that California is on Super Tuesday, which it usually is not, which was meant to make it so that voters would have a bigger say in the primary contest. Has that played out as they had hoped, though? Because since it's coming so soon after these first contests, the candidates haven't been able to spend as much time there as they would if it were a month from now.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's still California's voice is still dwarfed compared to little Iowa and New Hampshire. Clearly, the candidates always come out here for money. But in terms of the California candidates like Kamala Harris, Eric Swalwell, the East Bay congressman, they've dropped out of the race. And Tom Steyer, who's the only Californian left in the race, he's at 3% in our poll. So it hasn't helped the California candidates having this primary moved up. It, you know, of course, they've all come to California for money. And Pete Buttigieg, for example, has gotten much of the fuel that he used to really launch his campaign from California. But, you know, Donald Trump has raised a lot of money in California as well. But in terms of the impact, probably not exactly what it would be if California was a standalone contest, say, early on the calendar. But you have to go back to, say, 1968, I think, when Bobby Kennedy won the California primary to have a really hotly contested race among the Democrats. And, of course, he won that and was assassinated later that night.
Let's talk about just a couple of other things going on in California when it comes to the primary. Republican Duncan Hunter, congressman, resigned last month after pleading guilty to a corruption charge. Now a couple of high-profile California Republicans are running for that seat, slugging it out over who is more loyal to President Trump. What's going on with that race? And do Republicans run a risk of losing that district with the infighting?
That is a really heavily Republican district, Jeremy. It's a very much a likely Republican seat. You know, Duncan Hunter won in 2018 despite being indicted. And the guy that he beat, who did actually better than expected, Amar Campanajar, the Democrat, is raising money. He's running again this time. But there are two Republicans really slugging it out, as you said. Daryl Issa, who gave up his San Diego congressional seat a couple of years ago, he's running in this seat, as well as Carl DeMaio, a former San Diego City Councilman. He's a conservative talk show host. They're kind of splitting the Republican vote. And there is a poll out from the San Diego Union Tribune that shows Campanajar, the Democrat, with 35%. He's in first. And then Issa with 21 and Carl DeMaio at 15, sort of splitting that Republican vote. So it's likely with this top two system, we'll have a Republican and a Democrat facing off in November. And as I said, it is a pretty heavily Republican district.
That is Scott Schaefer at KQED in San Francisco, where he hosts Political Breakdown and is the politics editor. Scott, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And again, Here Now's Tanya Mosley will broadcast from South Carolina tomorrow and Friday. So tune in for that.
You might know Nick Kroll from his very raunchy animated show on Netflix, Big Mouth.
Are you the puberty fairy?
The puberty fairy? I'm the hormone monster. I'm not a fairy.
Well, now he's starring as a romantic lead in a movie set at the Olympics. Actor and comedian Nick Kroll, next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This is Borderline, the first single from the latest Tame Impala album called The Slow Rush. The song came out last year, but the album was finally released this month to critical acclaim. Just within the last year, Tame Impala has headlined the Coachella Music Festival and been the musical guest on Saturday Night Live. It is the brainchild of 34-year-old Kevin Parker of Perth, Australia, who writes, records, performs, produces, and mixes all of the music himself. But until now, he has never done an NPR interview. When we sat down together earlier this week, I asked him, since he does just about everything himself, how does he write his music?
Sometimes the best songs come to me when I'm completely preoccupied and just consumed with other parts of life. You know, I'm like in a busy place or I'm hurrying to get somewhere. I'm in an airport, you know.
Which one are you thinking of?
On this album, Breathe Deeper. In a grocery store.
That's when it came to you.
Mm-hmm. I just started humming the bass line to myself.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard that you will, like, do the drums with your mouth.
Oh, yeah. In fact, this is a radio show. I could probably do it. Oh, hang on.
I can hear that.
You can?
Yeah.
It's kind of just like grinding my teeth. I've done it since I was a kid, since before I could play drums. That's kind of it's kind of one of those things that it's sort of halfway between like a nervous twitch and a creative kind of thing, you know? It's like a weird combination of the two.
So tell me about The Slow Rush. What does that mean, first of all?
Time, for one. The way time is rushing, but it's also seemingly standing still, you know?
I did notice that almost every or most of the songs on The Slow Rush have some sort of time reference in the title.
Sure.
Yesterday, tomorrow.
Right. Which is actually kind of just something that I've noticed, you know, just like you did. And it's funny because I noticed, I was like, oh, there's a song yesterday and tomorrow. And then I was like, oh, there's one more year. Oh, there's even Instant Destiny.
Right.
Like Destiny kind of suggests.
And Instant.
Like, and Instant. I know. It's kind of, it's almost silly, isn't it?
So a friend of mine actually had a theory about this, and I want to run it by you, which is that, you know, you're 34 years old. A lot of people in our generation, I'm 37, mm-hmm. are kind of taking stock of their life and time and noticing that time is moving very quickly. And, you know, what are we leaving behind us and what are we looking forward to?
Mm-hmm.
Is there something to that? Are you the voice of the generation?
No. Oh, I was about to say probably before you said voice of a generation. I guess the way I look at it is like, that's for other people to figure out. At the same time, I also like to think that it's a kind of feeling you can have at any time in your life, you know? And particularly a time that's kind of like in between chapters of your life, you know. I remember feeling like that when I finished high school, like, wow, you know, my life is moving on. Like I can see, you know, in the way that your life is like a piece of string. It's got a start and an end. Mm-hmm. And we never really know where we are on that piece of string, you know, taking stock and seeing everything that has been and seeing everything that will be and having visions of the future and stuff like that.
Well, at this point in your life on that string, you are selling out Madison Square Garden, mm-hmm. headlining Coachella, hosting as a musical guest on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
How does it feel to you right now? Do you like all that attention?
Man, to be honest, none of that stuff compares to just making the music and people listening to it, especially because, like, that's the live incarnation of Tame Impala, you know. That's all the stuff that goes along with what I've achieved musically, you know. That's kind of like this stuff, like, that's going to happen. But I don't see those things as signs of my success.
What do you see as signs of your success?
Just reaching people. For me, getting, the album went number one in Australia just recently. And that was really touching to me. Because that stuff is like people actually listening and buying it.
This album is particularly self-reflective.
I think all my albums are.
Well, there's a song, Posthumous Forgiveness, mm-hmm. Which is a tough note to your dad, mm-hmm. who died of cancer, mm-hmm. And includes the lyrics, "Every single word you told me, I believed without a question always. To save all of us, you told us both to trust, but now I know you only saved yourself." That must have been emotionally very difficult to write.
Yeah, I mean, what's funny is, weirdly, it was kind of easy because of how ripe that emotion was. Mm-hmm. It's just something that's kind of, I've never really put it in music before or talked about it even. That's where the best lyrics come from. It's like sentiments and feelings and thoughts that you've not been able to previously talk about or like share or put into words, or, you know. So that's why music is good, because it's a way of turning it into something that you can express. And so in that way, like, those lyrics in Posthumous Forgiveness were some of the easiest to write on the album. Sometimes I'm writing lyrics and it feels like, you know, to use the fruit analogy, sometimes you're sort of like plucking a grapefruit off a tree that isn't ripe yet, and you're pulling at it, you know, you got to kind of tug it. And sometimes it just practically falls out, mm-hmm. you know. And those lyrics were like that, you know, they were ready to come out.
One review of this album said, "Almost everything sounds undisturbed by the trouble in the world." Do you find that when you're putting this together that you're able to leave the troubles of the world behind?
Yeah, I think that's kind of, it's funny, like, it's something that I've noticed about my music, is that, like, some music brings you into the world. It's like, it's so relevant, and it's so, like, if it's political or has a social message and stuff, which is always so great that music has the power to be able to do that. But, and there's some kind of types of music that remove you from the world, that are kind of escapist. And I think Tame Impala is part of that escapist category.
I want to ask you about Tame Impala's style right now, because it's changed. A lot of people have noticed that it's changed, that It was more rocky to begin with, and now it's something else. First of all, how would you describe it? What category, what genre does it fall into?
No idea.
No idea.
No idea. Well, it's funny, you know, I was sitting in the mastering room with Glenn, my label guys, I've worked on every album with him. And I said to Glenn, like, "Glenn, what sort of music is this?" And Glenn was like, "I don't know." He said, like, "Well, it's not hip hop."
The hip hop world seems to love you, though.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? mean, Rihanna covered one of your songs.
Mm-hmm.
You worked with Kanye.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think one of the most important parts of my music are the rhythms and, like, with beats and stuff, drum beats, drum patterns, even, like, vocal patterns, you know. To me, the rhythms and the syncopation of things and all that kind of stuff is almost more important than the melodic part of it. And I think hip-hop is built off a lot of the same kind of things.
You have been described as a mastermind, shy, introspective, a perfectionist, intimidating, a polymath.
Wait a minute. Can we go back to intimidating?
That somebody called you intimidating.
Okay.
The psych rock messiah.
Okay.
Are those all fair?
Sure. Why not? Because you know what? You should believe a little bit of your own myth, your own mythology. I always believed that was poisonous. Like the moment you start to believe your own hype is when you start sucking. But since appreciating the artist Kanye West, I guess I realized that it's good to have a bit of that. I think he said like once you should be the maximum version of yourself.
What do you want people to take away from this album?
I guess if I can help push along the theory that genres don't really exist anymore, especially, I'd be happy. I guess if this album is an album that makes people dream about their life, I know that sounds really weird, dream about their life, but because that was always something that I loved when I was a kid. It was like music that just kind of, for whatever reason, just made my life make sense, whether it was in a positive or negative way.
Hmm.
Just makes life seem more meaningful.
When do you start thinking about your next album?
Right now.
Are you already working on it?
Not physically, but one of the side effects of finishing an album is having this flourish of ideas of exactly what you want to do next, like immediately.
You're already
Because you just you automatically immediately start dreaming about doing everything you didn't do with this album.
Do you think it'll be another 5 years?
No.
Sooner?
Oh, way sooner, yeah.
Well, I have to say that I interview tons of people all the time. And in fact, in the last couple of weeks, I've talked to two presidential candidates.
Wow.
But this one was the one I was the most nervous about of all of it.
No way.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because
intimidating. Tick.
It is. You're intimidating. There you go. Kevin Parker, thank you so much for talking with me.
Of course, man. Thank you.
Kevin Parker, the man behind Tame Impala, which just released its fourth studio album, The Slow Rush, and is about to start its U.S. tour. More information at hereandnow.org.
Yesterday, there were several announcements from the federal government about the new coronavirus that seemed at odds. In India, President Trump said the virus was very well under control in the U.S. Hours later, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said it's not a matter of if the virus will spread across this country, but when. And at a Senate hearing yesterday, the acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, had a tough time answering basic questions about readiness, like, are there enough masks? Helen Branswell is with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. And Helen, we heard the not if, but when. So go deeper. How is the CDC telling families and businesses to prepare?
What they're effectively saying is that life may not be normal for a while. So they're urging people to try to find out from their children's schools whether or not kids will be going to school or if the school districts are considering closing schools. Obviously, people should be talking to their employers about could they work from home if they have the type of job that allows for that kind of arrangement to be made. So thinking about how will your life be disrupted and how will you cope with it?
Right. Hospitals might need to look into expanding telehealth services, we heard from the CDC. They also talked about voluntary home quarantines, surface cleaning methods. So they are serious about this, even though, as we know, what we're discovering about this new COVID-19 is that it may not be as fatal as some other outbreaks of illness are, but the transmission is pretty amazing.
it's very clear by now that this virus transmits a lot more efficiently than, say, something like SARS. This one, when it gets into a new place, it really spreads very nicely. You know, places like Italy and Iran didn't know they had any cases at the beginning of last week and now have had 19 deaths in Iran. That is why people are concerned that trying to stop it may be not really possible.
We mentioned that the Trump administration was questioned in hearings yesterday about, do we have respirators? Do we have masks? And finally, an official said, we have masks at Homeland Security, but no, people don't, there aren't enough masks. And there are also questions about testing kits.
Yeah, the CDC developed a test for states. When they sent it out, they thought it was working properly. In the hands of the state labs, it was not working as well. They had trouble with one part of the test kit, and the CDC effectively had to pull it back. The only places currently that are able to seem to be able to operate it properly are California, Nebraska, and Illinois, and they are allowed to test. When you look at the numbers here in comparison to some other countries, fewer than 500 people have been tested in the United States, whereas in the UK, I saw yesterday, 6,000 people had been tested.
Well, Helen Branswell, you said you were on a call with the WHO. What else can we learn in the U.S. from them?
So the call I was on yesterday was very interesting. It was a press conference given by a WHO official who had led an international mission to China. He actually felt that China had been very effective in slowing the spread of the virus outside of Hubei province. It's not clear that the approaches that China has taken could be instituted in very many other countries in the world. I mean, they've locked down tens of millions of people.
As one official said to us, can you imagine New York City in lockdown? No.
Yeah.
Helen Branswell with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication, with an update on COVID-19. Helen, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Mr. Steyer.
I think we're talking about
that.
We'll
get to you, Mr. Sanders.
Let's talk about it.
Can
I say something? Look, first of all,
let me go.
Last night's Tower of Babel, during which a Democratic debate occasionally broke out, the CBS moderators are being taken to task for not corralling the candidates better. But what else can we take away from what we heard, the way we hear it, especially from the women? In 2016, the Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton was called shrill, even though voice analysis showed hers was average in pitch and loudness for people her age and gender. Sherry Turkle is closely listening, and she says something radical is going on this time. She's author of many books, including Reclaiming Conversation, and she's founding director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self, How We Talk in the Digital World. She's on Skype from New York. Sherry, your thoughts first on this cacophony last night.
Well, Stephen Colbert closed his monologue last night, calling this basically a food fight, and it did look like a frat party. If women had been alone on that stage, it would have been disqualifying for all of them.
Well, the reviews have been negative, even though it was mostly men on the stage. But are you saying it would have been more so?
Absolutely. If that had been Klobuchar, Warren, and Harris screaming at each other, that would have been the end of the careers of those three women.
Elizabeth Warren was very firm, as she has been, in laying out that she's the person with plans.
I've been in the Senate when I've seen gun safety legislation introduced, get a majority, and then doesn't pass because of the filibuster. Understand this, the filibuster is giving a veto to the gun industry.
Our friend, the Boston Globe writer, Renee Graham, tweeted out, mark my words, tomorrow people are going to say she sounded angry when she's just speaking forcefully. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. I was on Twitter during the debate, and there is a lot of things like, I'm done. I've had enough. She's gone.
Well, after the debate in Nevada, Washington Post columnist Jennifer Rubin said mean and angry is not a good look for Warren. Rubin went on to say, her righteous but naked aggression made some women uncomfortable.
Well, I would go further. I would say it made some men uncomfortable, that if you actually look at what she's saying and her tone of voice, it's extremely controlled, but it's controlled the way a prosecutor is controlled. I mean, she is prosecuting a case. But listen to what Bloomberg said about her last night.
And I don't know what else she wants us to do.
Oh, I'll be
clear. We're following exactly what she asked to do.
I'll tell you exactly
what I want you to do. And the trouble is, with this senator, enough is never enough.
Nothing is enough for her.
Now, this was Michael Bloomberg following what some say was one of the most fascinating and for some very disturbing moments in the debate. This was after Elizabeth Warren, first of all, talked about a story we've heard that when she was a young mother and was pregnant, she was told to leave the business. But then she pivoted and said, today we have Michael Bloomberg, and I'm paraphrasing, saying, kill it. Let's listen to that moment.
At least I didn't have a boss who said to me, kill it, the way that Mayor Bloomberg
never
alleged
said that.
To have said to one of his pregnant employees.
Now, we have to put this in context, Sherry Turkle. This is someone who worked for Michael Bloomberg. A young woman said that that was his response when she told him that she was pregnant. He denies that he said that. Your thoughts on that moment?
Well, when he says nothing is enough for her, that language is as though he's talking about placating an angry spouse. But I find that kind of language in talking about women's anger in this contest is widely used, as though nothing will be enough for her. And it's that kill it moment which really froze the debate, because it's really the most radical thing that happened. And it continued on in her interview with Chris Matthews, where Chris Matthews kept saying, you believe he's lying just to protect himself. Why would he do that? You think he's that kind of person? I mean,
but we have to say he denies he said it, even though, according to reporting, there was a witness in the room who heard him say it. And of course, the woman says that he said it. But I'm wondering if, just from a sheer debate analysis, you say the room froze. I'm betting it's in part because the people I was sitting with had no idea what she was talking about. They hadn't heard this story. Did she make a mistake? She has been, you know, putting daggers in Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah.
Did she make a mistake this time, do you think?
She may have made a mistake because people weren't familiar enough with the incident, whereas when she was talking about the NDAs, they were more familiar with the story.
The non-disclosure agreements, yeah.
Yes. But I think that why somebody like Bloomberg has a hard time even feeling that he's done something wrong, because this whole discussion has taken place, if it took place, in an atmosphere where it's being discussed in a kind of as if land
well,
in their heads.
Yeah, it's also on his territory. It's, you know, he's the boss.
Yes.
I want to ask you about something else, Sherry Turkle. We've been reading a great Cognoscenti article here at our home station, WBUR. It was written by Julia Witz Schlack. She quotes Heather Sylvain Horn, who sets up the premise about all the female candidates this time around. Acceptable female passion and aggression in American culture is typically cloaked in the language of motherhood. So Clinton was the it takes a village mom. Sarah Palin was the hockey mom, the mama grizzly. Warren, Klobuchar, I would say, you know, some of the other candidates, female candidates as well, who aren't on the stage, are not portraying themselves as moms.
I think that's absolutely right. As a matter of fact, Amy Klobuchar almost had a death-defying, killing her candidacy moment when it came out that she ate her food with a comb.
And who hasn't been there?
I mean, people went berserk because on an airplane, when they didn't give her an implement, she ate her food with a pocket comb. I mean, a mom would tear that pocket comb out of a child's hand and say, never do that.
Well, she also was called in that incident somebody who was mean to the people who worked with her. And, you know, we always keep those kind of open for question because a woman, again, can be called mean or angry in the same case where a man might just be aggressive.
Exactly. And all of the women who ran, Kamala Harris, Gillibrand, none of them really came out as, you know, with their maternal bona fides being put forward first. Look at how Hillary Clinton came back in the primaries last time. She cried.
After New Hampshire, yeah.
After New Hampshire, and she broke down in tears that people were willing to take a second look at her. So it was a completely different kind of candidate, a completely different kind of vibration. Mm. So I think we're seeing a revolution and how women are allowing themselves to appear on the national stage. And I think that people are actually having a hard time with it, a very hard time with it.
Just briefly on Amy Klobuchar, there's a great picture going around. And again, you've been watching social media. That's that's your expertise. There was that great picture of her standing with kind of her hands up in exasperation between Tom Steyer and Joe Biden as they argued over her head, as if she wasn't there. But talk about some of her comments. She criticized somebody's policy by comparing it to, you know, you think you're just going to bring a hot dish over to Russia?
Exactly.
So it does feel as if she does feel that she has to put in some of those, you know, those signals that signal I'm still someone who can bake.
I think Amy Klobuchar is trying to have it both ways. She signals this kind of down-home folksiness, not just by talking about her kind of third way, but by making these gestures towards cooking and food and hot dishes and a kind of hominess. On the other hand, she has been, you could argue, that her style of attacking Buttigieg showed a kind of unbridled hostility.
Klobuchar also had that famous statement. Of course, the women on the stage, do I think we would be standing on that stage if we had the experience Pete Buttigieg had? No, I don't.
Exactly. She actually called it out. But she actually had the bravery to say to Pete, are you making fun of me?
Do you think I'm dumb?
Are you talking down to me?
No.
These gender things have been very raw and discussed and very out there. Mm.
Sherry Turkle, she watches how we speak to each other. That's what she does in her books. And also, she's the founding director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self program in science, technology, and science. Sherry, thank you so much for your observations.
My pleasure.
Stocks stabilized this morning after plummeting over the last 2 days. The Dow is now in negative territory for the year. Investors worried about manufacturing, supply chains, and weakened consumer demand as the coronavirus outbreak has moved beyond China into South Korea, Europe, and beyond. Joining us now to look at the economic side of the story is Diane Swonk, who is chief economist at Grant Thornton in Chicago. Hi, Diane.
Hello.
So keeping in mind that the stock market is not the economy, when the Dow falls almost 2,000 points in 2 days, isn't that sure to have an impact on jobs, on individual companies, and what they can do over the next several months?
Well, one of the biggest impacts in terms of the stock market falling is its impact on baby boomers. And what we saw back in 2018 during the height of the trade war fears and the plummet in the stock market, which was similar in magnitude to what we're seeing today, was a collapse in spending by those baby boomers worrying about what they're going to do about retirement. It's a very asymmetric relationship. When the stock market rallies, they don't spend a lot more because they're saving for retirement or they're closer into retirement already. And so it really has been a boomer phenomena that's tied to the stock market in terms of consumption. And the consumer, of course, has been the backbone of the economy, even as businesses pulled in recent quarters.
Are you worried about a recession now as a result of what we're seeing because of the coronavirus?
I certainly hope we avoid it, but I think the risks of a global recession have gone up quite significantly. This is really unique in the way that it affects economies. We don't have a health pandemic yet, which is great, but we do have what I'd call an economic pandemic, and that is efforts to contain the contagion of the coronavirus, or COVID-19, as they're now calling it, are actually stopping economic activity, stopping production, quarantining people, and those are lost sales that can't be easily recouped or remedied by fiscal stimulus or cuts in rates. And I think that's what's so difficult for the financial markets to get their arms around is some of these lost sales. If you lose a sweater sale in February in some part of the world, you're not going to recoup it in April. And so some of these lost sales are permanent. And then there's a question of how long it takes to ramp up after the quarantines are lifted. What we're seeing in the extreme in places like China is not only do they have to go in and sterilize factories, logistics are really quite daunting, but they have to wait for migrant workers to make it back after the Lunar New Year vacations, which were extended. They're not getting paid right now. And, you know, they also have to be quarantined when they get back as well.
Well, in China, the economy was already slowing down a bit before the coronavirus outbreak began. Now, JP Morgan is expecting negative GDP growth there this quarter. What would that mean?
Well, this is, we expect it as well. Whether they print it or not, we'll see if they print it, but the effects are the same. That's the second largest economy in the world, and we're also now flirting with negative growth in Japan, Germany, Italy, Korea. These are major economies in the global economy, so we very likely will see the weakest growth we've seen and maybe even turn negative outside of the U.S. for the first time since the Great Recession.
Can the U.S. insulate itself if we've got negative growth happening in all those other countries, major economies around the world?
Well, we're not an island into ourselves, and what happens abroad matters on the U.S. economy. The dollar is also strengthening. We have some offsetting factors like prices at the pump going down and interest rates, mortgage rates plummeting. At the same time, all this is happening to help buffet this. But the real issue is not only do we have global supply chains that are likely to fit, which means production in the U.S. is likely to be affected in March. It's just beginning to hit because people had prepared for the Lunar New Year closures, and now they're just starting to get the sort of bottlenecks in the pipeline of production. So that is still ahead of us. And then any kinds of collateral damage we have from an outbreak here, and the fear factor, fear and precaution when it comes to something like this behave in the same way in the economy. And again, you get that sense of people not showing up at public places, not showing up at sporting events, not going out to the movies. All those things take a toll on the economy that are hard to recoup and hard to stimulate to buffer against.
Diane, we're going to hear from President Trump in a news conference this evening. And I wouldn't be surprised if he comes out and asks the Fed to do more to boost the economy. Is there much the Fed can do at this point if we start to see some slowdown as a result of COVID-19?
Well, there's no question that the Fed is monitoring what's going on. They've been very clear about that in recent days. I was with them as they were making their remarks about that and meetings in Washington, that they're monitoring the situation closely. And, you know, if it affects our growth and growth abroad, they'll have to act. And I do think that they will end up having to cut rates. The question is, how much will that help the current situation? It will help firms that, you know, have losses and all of a sudden they need lower interest rates to weather the storm. So on the margin, the fragility for those firms that, you know, we've got a lot of near junk bond and a lot of junk bond out there. And that's the concern, is that even with a cut in interest rates, that will help those firms weather the storm, but it won't cure what ails them if they really have permanent losses in some of their sales. And so they can do something on the margin, but there is no silver bullet on this kind of a shock.
That is Diane Swonk, chief economist at Grant Thornton in Chicago. Diane, thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, Robin, we are watching other news about the coronavirus today. Brazil confirmed the first case in Latin America in a 61-year-old man who recently returned from Italy. And in France, Nice, the city of Nice, canceled the last day of its carnival celebration. And, of course, Ash Wednesday is today. Masses canceled in Venice, Milan, and Bologna, Italy. Here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
I'm Tanya Mosley in South Carolina ahead of Saturday's primary. After that mass shooting almost 5 years ago at Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, legislators are pushing to get a hate crimes law passed.
To them, it's not necessarily a feel-good type of legislation. It is just something to say, I hear your pain, I understand your struggle.
That's next time on Here and Now.